Lisa Mills, assistant professor of film at UCF, and you're listening to The Riches Documentary Podcast.
One huge influence that came out of Calvary was the televangelist Benny Hinn. Benny Hinn found the start of his widely known crusades in Orlando at Calvary Assembly. He found support from the church, which helped facilitate his future efforts.
You know, Benny Hinn's ministry is very much in keeping with a tradition within the Pentecostal charismatic movement. And in fact, Hinn himself will talk about the fact that he was sort of trained or shepherded in his work by Catherine Kuhlman. And Catherine Kuhlman, Oral Roberts, many others have for the last part of the 20th century have been very active in their healing ministry.
Benny and his family migrated to Canada from the Middle East, and he met Pastor Harthorn in England, and the two struck up a friendship. Benny Hinn came to Florida. He was very closely affiliated with Calvary for a number of years. He held prayer meetings here, Bible studies. He ministered in the services, and he actually had used several of the buildings on the church property as his ministry offices for a number of years.
One of the main reasons that Benny Hinn found himself at Calvary Assembly was because of the daughters of the church's pastor.
Benny Hinn had a ministry that was based in Toronto, and he wanted to come to the States. And he happened to be on an airplane. Roy Harthorn, who was the pastor of Calvary Assembly at the time. And so they got to talking, and Roy found out that he was had a healing ministry. And Benny found out that Roy had a couple daughters. So he was interested in meeting them. So Roy arranged for Benny to come here to Winter Park at Calvary and conduct a major healing service. He was well received by the church, and Benny was met Roy's daughters, and he decided to come back more regularly, and it developed a relationship between Roy's oldest daughter, Suzanne.
There has been many varying perceptions of Benny Hinn's ministry, intentions, and practices.
You know, the people, instead of really getting too serious about God, they're looking for healing, they're looking for miracles, not really getting serious about what God. When Benny was in town, the church was packed. When he's not there, it's almost empty. So they're not looking for God, they're looking for miracles or looking for something to help them right now. So Benny gets carried away. Mark Rodden was also a pastor here and a good friend of ours, a good friend of mine. And this is what Mark Rutland said. First of all, he said there's nothing wrong with Benny Hinn that a good seminary teaching couldn't correct.
He's always faced criticism, but he had it here in Orlando. Wasn't the newspapers. It was some other group, a church group. Faced it everywhere he went, though. He had criticism from national sources that he was under attack because they never wanted to believe the miracles were legitimate. The religious group, and I can't think of the name now, but they used to come and picket at the church, because they thought that his theology was wrong.
And it was that supernatural element of it that drew people in, and it really is that that's not necessarily something that's that unique to him, or even we might say that unique to American Christianity. Certainly not unique to American Christianity in the 20th century. You can find a number of examples of people who made supernatural healing the centerpiece of their work and their ministry. I think where what Benny Hinn has that's unique is that he's combining the healing ministry with television ministry. He's doing it in the 21st century. He does it in a very confident and aggressive fashion. He oftentimes offends people by how aggressive he is with some of his iterations of how he'll use the spirit to defend himself against his enemies. Those types of things have gotten him in trouble. But at the core, it seems that what he has done is he's combined these various strands of ministry, many of which overlap with other people as well. The prosperity gospel, focus on supernatural healing, the use of television ministry and events, and that sort of aggressive swagger that oftentimes makes the most popular television personalities, whether they're religious or not, stand out over time. So, I think that, the fact that he's been successful and that he's become popular is just, at least at one level, it's the combination of a lot of those different factors and the personality with which he does his work.
The uprising of evangelicalism among the youth gave rise to the Jesus Festivals, which were held by Calvary Assembly on land that is now owned by Disney. Tens of thousands of people flocked to the Jesus Festivals to hear prominent speakers and musicians. Described as a Christian Woodstock, the final Jesus Festival saw approximately 30,000 people in attendance.
It's kind of your idea of a Christian Woodstock, I guess, would be the best way to describe it. He had a vision of bringing all these people together in a wide open space, so they actually went down to land, which is now part of Disney's land. People could bring their tents and camp. It was like for three or four days, and they had all kinds of well-known Christian speakers and music groups come down, so there was always something going on at all times, and Calvary was the backbone behind that. Calvary put it together, planned it. It was a ton of work, but people enjoyed it, and it was famous in the 70s, and they did it for 3 or 4 years straight, but that was Pastor Alex's vision, so... Rock House was actually founded by one of Calvary's former pastors, Alex Clattenburg, who before he became the senior pastor was the youth pastor. And Alex started a youth ministry in 1970. 17 people is what I understand it started as, became known as Rock House. And within 4 years' time, there was about 450 attending the weekly meetings. And within a decade, they said they had about 750 to 1,000 kids coming. They had to, because the church was not large enough, which was this auditorium here, the youth went to Johnson Hall and had their own service on Sunday. So there would be more room for the adults in here. But they also had their service in the week as well. So Rock House was... famous in Central Florida, and so many young people from all different backgrounds came to Rock House. Their friends would bring them. It was known as the place to be at the time, and so there's so many people that really, got their spiritual roots at Rock House, say still people that I know to this day that, and they actually had a Rock House reunion, I think, a number of years ago, and it was well attended. They had it here at Calvary. So,
Calvary Assembly experienced extreme growth throughout its history. In 1977, Calvary Assembly had to provide 5 services each Sunday to cater to the enormous congregation. And in 1978, Christian Life magazine recognized Calvary as the fastest growing church, not just in the entire state of Florida, but in the whole United States.
There may be some different explanations for this. It seems to me that one reason that, and I think when you look at the time period in which larger churches begin to take off, you go back to around the 1970s, and I would directly correlate the rise of those larger congregations and, you know, that threshold of around 2,000 members with around that time period. Now, certainly there were larger churches before that, but if you were to measure the number of churches that reach that threshold, I think it starts to reach a higher point by the 70s and 80s. I think there's a connection there with the sort of prominence of television ministry and television evangelism. The fact is that most of the people that had established a sort of television presence or a popular media presence with their ministries typically were pastors of those types of churches, of those larger churches. And by correlation, when your typical church in a random Midwestern town started to get more than 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 people a week, you also found that oftentimes they brought in television cameras and they became sort of the local version of the the sort of Oral Roberts or Jim and Tammy Baker on the national level. So there's some sense of imitation at work here. There's some sense of churches wanting to reach that threshold because, you know, by the time you get to the late 80s and the term megachurch is becoming more common, it becomes a sort of badge of honor for a pastor or a spiritual leader to say, you know, I've now reached this. We can call ourselves a megachurch. We've reached this number.
Calvary Assembly has been a model for innovation and pioneering in the realm of churches and their practices.
Calvary was kind of like the beginning of a lot of things that became a part of church life. You know what I'm saying? Like a lot of things happened at Calvary first before they happened anywhere else. And Calvary was really well known for, you know, everybody. Calvary Assembly was kind of like the model, you know, back then. It was like, well, you know, Calvary's getting it started. Other churches would send people here to learn what we were doing because the growth explosion was so quickly, you know, so quick and so large back then that it was phenomenal. And people were sending people here to see, well, what are they doing, you know?
The innovativeness of Calvary Assembly was both a cause and an after effect of the rapid growth of the megachurch. Calvary was a catalyst for change in many different areas.
You know, they were on the cutting edge of everything. They weren't afraid to try new things. The people that were here had vision to do something great. And, you know, they weren't afraid to step out in faith and do something, you know, and take a chance. And also, I think it was partly timing. I think it was just, it seemed at that time, point in time, that was the whole charismatic renewal time. And so the church was ripe for something different. It became kind of, at that time, Calvary was like something different, something new. It was like a fresh wind was blowing through the church. And Calvary was doing all these new things, you know, that kind of caught people's attention because they were tired of just the same old, you know, and this was something new that was happening. There was a lot of life here, and, you know, and when there's life, there's growth.
Dr. Hammond shares his knowledge and insights on evangelicalism.
And so the modern use of evangelicalism, or sometimes what we call neo-evangelicals, are really formed in the 1940s and become well-established in the 1950s, and it's specifically over a desire to break from the fundamentalists. And the question over which the new evangelicals broke away from the fundamentalists was really not one that had much to do with core beliefs or doctrines or even many of those doctrines in the fundamentals, but it had to do with the application of those beliefs, prominence in American life. So the long answer here is a short history on not just the word, but on the movement. The word today, you know, gets thrown around a lot of different ways, but historically what it means is an adherence to the gospel. And what it's meant since at least the 1950s is a very strong application of that gospel toward not only personal salvation, but toward the redemption of the culture at large.
The effects of evangelicals in Central Florida can be clearly seen. From just one megachurch in Winter Park, so many entities such as institutions, organizations, publications, television channels, and influential individuals have emerged. These products of evangelicalism have contributed significantly to the history and makeup of Central Florida. And out of this local area, immense influence has spread nationally and internationally.
Thank you for listening to the Richest Documentary Podcast. Feel free to contact us with any questions or comments on the program that you just heard. Please join us for the next episode, Public History in Central Florida, an interview with Gene Yaver.